Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Fuel your day with Green Fern's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
And thanks as always to Jenny Green for the last couple of hours of company. It is Monday the 1st of November. You're very welcome to Game On. Coming up today, Stephen Kelly and Alan Colley on the sacking at Spurs, who, let's be very honest, will not be long without a manager, with Antonio Conte waiting in the wings.
I always talk about education and respect. And if someone haven't the good attitude during the training session or good behaviors in different circumstances, I prefer to kill him and to earn,
Fair play. So in rugby, Stephen Ferris will put some perspective on the All Blacks' performance at the weekend when they absolutely trashed the Welsh, and Andy Farrell has called this exciting prospect into his squad.
Hansen's after it. He got up very, very early. Oh, he's hit the ground running. Mac Hansen steps inside. Can he make it all the way? Three or four Bulls players, and none of them can lay a glove on Mac Hansen. Goodness me, that is an unbelievable way to open your try scoring account for Connacht. Listen to the noise around the Galway sports ground.
A little bit hoarser than we're used to hearing the man himself. It's been an eventful few days in horse racing. Ruby will get us up to speed as well, and we will mark the card ahead of the Melbourne Cup, which gets underway in a couple of hours' time.
Game on 2FM.
If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FN. Damien, you're in the hot seat tonight. Had you a good weekend?
I did, nice and quiet. You know, I don't know if you and I have spoken about this in the past. I've got into the habit. I'm today's day one back after 10 days off. Deleted the work email from my phone. Pretty much deleted social media apps from my phone. Switched off completely. I watched Bows against Derry on Friday night, which I'm trying to forget about.
You switched off completely.
Well, you see, but that's like an indulgence, you know, that's an indulgence. That's not work. And I listened to the Liverpool match on the radio over the weekend, which I probably should try and forget about as well.
But that was a highlight, wasn't it?
Yeah. Do you know, you start to, and we'll talk to the lads about this in due course, but the psychology of sport is really interesting, isn't it? United go out and get hammered the weekend before. They're a new team then against Spurs, albeit they were only playing Spurs. Liverpool like set the world on fire against United, and then I always start to worry when managers start coming out afterwards talking about the body language and not being impressed with the body language and players' attitudes and stuff. Surely it's Klopp's job and his management team's job to make sure lads' heads are in the right place.
Yeah, well, I love the confidence one. You'd imagine, like, people say so much about sport is confidence, and there's the exact analogy that it's not. Because the Liverpool players should have been all confidence, the United players should have been on the floor, yet the results are the other way around. So, I don't know. People say sport is all about confidence. I'm never so sure it was.
Well, come here now. Give me that then from your perspective. Did you have days that you went out thinking to yourself, there isn't anything going to go right for me today?
No, I didn't. I firmly believe confidence is only the ability to think in a positive manner. But I was always a realist, Damien. Mm. And I could go to the races with seven rides and think, you know what, I'm going to need a miracle to ride a winner. But it didn't mean I didn't try.
Okay.
Happen. And you try to hope maybe you get one that could finish third to go and win the race or something. But no, I didn't think that no matter what I do, I'm not doing it right. Because to me, if you just did the very same thing as you did yesterday when you rode the winner, it's not change anything. It's the trick. Or try not to change anything and keep repeating yourself, don't change it, that works, don't change it, don't start making rash decisions because something hasn't worked, which we see all the time in sport.
What else, what about yourself? Anything exciting or exhilarating from
a
sporting
weekend
context?
I thought the All Blacks trashing the Welsh, that was a magic game to watch.
It's frightening though, isn't it?
It is, we'll see what Stephen Ferris says. Were the Welsh that bad or were the All Blacks that brilliant from what I watched of it? I just thought the All Blacks were incredible.
Yeah. Like, I know you can make the argument that the Welsh were down on players, but at the same time, if that team rocked out in the Six Nations next year, you're not going to, the build up over the course of the week wouldn't be, oh, here we're going to face a massively depleted Welsh team. Like, the Welsh weren't that depleted. Okay, they were missing players, but they still had a pretty good team on the pitch.
It was just the All Blacks' ability to absolutely hammer home every half mistake, not full mistakes, a stray kick, and all of a sudden they were in over your try line. It was incredible.
It's one of those ones, like, you know, you have moments that you say to yourself, like, I've seen Messi in the flesh, or I've, you know, like, let's be very honest, the Aviva Stadium next week is sold out because there's a whole lot of people want to see Ronaldo and Bruno Fernandes in the flesh as much as we want to go and support Stephen Kenny's squad along the way. But, like, every time you get to see the All Blacks in the flesh, it's just one of those tick-a-box moments. And the hack, or maybe, are we all buying into building up this hype that there's something more than just a rugby team if we start to even refer to, like, there are coaches in world rugby who would, like, have you fined if you were a player who referred to them as the All Blacks and not referred to them as New Zealand? Do we buy into the aura a bit too much?
Possibly, but I definitely bought into the performance at the weekend, Damien. There's no doubt about that. I mean, Bowden Barrett, Jordy Barrett, they were just incredible. We'll talk to Fez about it in a while, but I just thought they were amazing to watch. Then I thought the soccer was brilliant. Liverpool drew, City got beat, United won. I just thought Saturday was a wonderful afternoon, you know, great racing in Down Royal. Colin Keane capped it all off in Nace yesterday. So, yeah, nothing to give out about. I just thought it was a pretty, really good weekend sport.
So Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is a hero yet again.
Yeah, no, it was another highlight of the weekend. No message from Carly telling me what Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is doing wrong. Mind you, he wouldn't even text me to tell me what he did right, which I was a bit disappointed.
Come here, he's with us. We're going to be joined by Stephen Kelly in a second as well. But Alan is on the phone. Hey, Alan.
Evening, Damien. Evening, Ruby.
Come here. Well, you were forget about the match and forget about everything that happened. You were mixing it with the great and the good of world football at the weekend. You had one of those once in a lifetime moments with your little fella.
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing, Damien. His first game over there, obviously, so we couldn't have asked for a better game. He was obviously disappointed with the result, but in terms of the people we were meeting and mixing with, obviously, but I think there was only one name that really stole the show over the weekend, and he was nothing to do with Spurs, nothing to do with Man United, and nothing to do with the game on Saturday in terms of being involved. He was only there working for Danish TV, but to meet Michael Laudrup was something else.
Yeah, top notch. It's not bad,
Ruby.
It
doesn't get much better than that.
No, it doesn't. No, what exactly did he do at the weekend that has you so excited?
Well, he was working for Danish TV, so we saw him before the match, and of course I spotted him straight away, and he would have been one of my favourites in terms of growing up over the years, and what a player, as everybody knows. But when I decided to go down and try and nab him for a photograph with my little lad was looking at me as much as, who's this fella, Dad? But we went down and he was really nice, he was lovely, got a photo and all. So that was only the start of it, Damien, and obviously it got better, and we had a great weekend. So, and then the match itself, I'm sure we're going to discuss it now, but we had a great weekend, thanks be to God.
I presume, Ruby, you've had those moments as well of, like, pushing the kids to get a picture with someone that the kids have no idea who they are just because you want to meet them yourself, or probably more likely there's a whole litany of young lads have pictures with Ruby Walsh going, who's your man?
I doubt it, Damien. I doubt it. But I mean, actually, no, I don't have a litany of those stories to tell you the God honest truth. Grand. I think we move on to the soccer.
Yeah.
So what went right this week that couldn't go right last week?
Well, to be fair to them, I think we, before the match, we were all obviously waiting with bated breath just to see how they would line up in the formation after what went wrong, as you said, the previous week, and getting humiliated against Liverpool. So I think, to be fair to Solskjaer, he probably deserves a little bit of credit for the way they lined up, but it was probably more he had no choice but to go that way, and they were very defence orientated, but he decided to play three at the back because Varane was back, but he played him alongside Lindelof and Maguire, but played with wing backs who were essentially the two full backs, Luke Shaw and Wan-Bissaka, and again the two defensive shielded midfielders were Fred and McTominay in front of them as well. So effectively he had seven defence minded players in the team and left it to Bruno Fernandes, Ronaldo and Cavani to obviously try and win the match for them. And to be fair to the match itself, Ruby, it wasn't the best game in the world, and I know people can look at the scoreline and think Solskjaer was a bit of a masterclass or whatever phrase you want to put on it, but it was far from it, because even though they did win 3-0 and it was comprehensive, you have to factor in just how bad Spurs were. And sometimes you can't be too critical, and sometimes you can't go too strong in terms of when you do criticise players, but I absolutely thought Spurs were a holy disgrace at the weekend. They were absolutely shocking, and it's no surprise to see the manager getting the sack today, because you mentioned here about Klopp and talking about effort and body language. What I watched on Saturday from professional footballers, and it's probably the worst criticism you could ever label at players that they weren't trying, but what I watched on Saturday, as I say, was nothing short of a disgrace from some of the players. They were absolutely embarrassing in terms of their effort and endeavour. There was probably only two or three that stood out for them that actually looked like they were trying, which is indicative really of everything and how bad they were. So that says it all, really. But in terms of Solskjaer and getting the result, I wouldn't be getting too carried away. They obviously have Atalanta tomorrow night. They have Man City at the weekend. It was 3-0 and they did well, but there was only one superstar on show, really, and that was Ronaldo. As for everyone else, it was fairly ordinary stuff.
Stephen, I felt the same watching United last week, that when Liverpool got a couple up, they gave up. Alan is saying the same there about the Spurs players giving up. Alan pointed a finger at the manager last week. He's pointing at the manager again this week. But you were a player. As professional players on the pitch, how can you just give up?
You can't and you shouldn't. It's always the book's always going to stop with the manager, and he's the one that's going to lose jobs regardless of what the players are doing, because he's the one that's in charge of getting them up to level. But for those players, and again watching the game myself, it was just the effort and the lack of effort from them was unbelievable. And you know, you don't take anything away from United, but United weren't amazing. They had moments of brilliance. Ronaldo was just the guys. They should just build a team around them and do what they should to get him to score goals, because he was sensational, I think, for most of the game. But Tottenham just were like, oh, their effort and the lack of desire and tackling, and you know, they won. Like I said, Moura was probably one of the players that was actually trying hard. The manager took him off. So decisions like that, when you have a player that actually is running around and trying to do make things happen, and trying to get on the ball, and was probably showing bits of quality, and then you take him off, then you just hear the fans start booing him. And yeah, from a player's perspective, I know they always say you lose the change room, and you think you're going to go out and give everything, but something kind of creeps into the whole side where it's not effort, it's just there's a lack of, I don't know, the lack of willingness to work for that manager, or you don't think that things are going to work out regardless of how you go out and play. And I think that's just something that creeps into sides when the manager is not getting the best from them.
So, Alan, the players were against Nuno. And then, or other players, the fans were the first ones to start giving out about him. And then when you lose the crowd, do the players just roll with the crowd and move on to manager?
Yeah, I'm not so sure. If you look at some of the games leading up to that, and obviously the heavy defeat against Arsenal never looked good. And sometimes there's a way to lose a match as well. And what I watched on Saturday is certainly not the way to lose a match, because the one thing that you should be given no matter what is your effort and your drive, your desire. And even looking at like the turn to Ndombele, and I watched him warming up before the match, and if ever I saw a fellow with absolutely no interest in coming on in a match, it was shocking, really. And it's unforgivable, because the stadium's incredible, the money these lads are getting paid in terms of the shop beforehand and what the fans are paying for tickets and for merchandise and all sorts. It's unforgivable, and Stephen's right about the moment in the match, particularly when it all turned, was Lucas Moura, who was actually one of the players that was doing really well, or he was trying to do well anyway, and he was giving it his all. He took him off, and I couldn't believe he actually took him off, but the reaction from the fans, and once that happened, I never saw a reaction like it in a stadium, and once that happened, I said to myself, he has no chance here, the manager, he's done, because the whole place completely turned on him. And then you look at the goals that they were giving away, and it wasn't just that, there was four or five as well. It wasn't just Ndombele. You could pick out four or five who I thought were really out of order, but the manager's turning to the likes of Ndombele, bringing him on and all. So the buck does stop with him. He's responsible for it. Those Stephen or Damien even mentioned earlier on about Klopp, it's up to the manager to motivate the players, and it is absolutely. I know there's personal pride involved, and they have to, obviously they're getting well paid to do their job, but ultimately it comes down to the manager to be motivating them players. And if a fella is not doing it for you, don't pick him and don't play him. He has that responsibility, that manager, and he can make that decision. And some of the fellas he was playing at the weekend, I just couldn't believe what I was watching, because again, as Stephen said, Man United were no great shakes at the weekend whatsoever. And if there was ever a time to play Man United, it was Saturday, when you think of the pressure Solskjaer was under coming off the back of that result against Liverpool as well, so low in confidence. That was the perfect time, in front of your own fans, 60,000 in front of an unbelievable stadium. That was the perfect time to play them, and it made it so easy for Man United. But in saying that as well, with Ronaldo is on a different level. And for all the criticism I've heard from people, many people saying Ronaldo's the problem, he's absolutely not the problem. Stephen is 100% right. He's the fella that's carrying this team, scoring all the goals, and they should be coming up with a formation and a system to build around Ronaldo. And I think they got that right on Saturday, to be fair to Solskjaer, having Cavani up alongside him doing a lot of the work, and Fernandes behind him, because he was just sensational, Ronaldo.
But Stephen, just on Spurs and the turnaround, like if you remember, and I think it could have been you I was talking to on this programme, three games into the league, they'd beaten Man City on on the opening day, beaten Wolves the second weekend, Watford the third weekend, three wins from three, top of the table. At that point, I think Arsenal had lost all three matches and we were doing, you know, Nuno was God. International break, yeah. You lose three in a row. So like, how has he gone from being manager of the month in August to being sacked at the start of November?
Results, 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 isn't it? And I think it's more than just the results, as much as that's what it comes down to. I think a couple of factors. They've obviously had someone lined up that they wanted to get in, and there's Daniel Levy, his office is at the training ground. He spends so much time there seeing the ins and outs and what's going on. And you just sense that with the way the players were performing on the pitch, there was a lot of disgruntlement. They weren't performing for him. And I hate the phrase "lost the change room" because I just think it's just hate that word. I hate saying it, but that seems like what's happened. And I don't know how it's gone from the start they've had to now. But there's talks about that the players with the training sessions and they weren't happy with that sort of stuff. And yeah, that you sometimes you have to just get on with it. But as a player, if you have a manager that you feel is going to, you, what you're doing is going to win you games or get you an opportunity to win titles or win something, which is what Tottenham are trying to achieve, that's where those players would jump on board anything you're trying to coach them, whereas they obviously went and felt that. And then I think what's a massive factor is Harry Kane. Like, he's adopted the situation, he's just come into a situation, inherited a sort of say that Harry Kane is totally unsettled and doesn't want to be there. It was so evident in the summer. Since he's come back, his body language, he looked like he doesn't want to be there. And that was a horrible situation for him to take on as a manager, because a strong, motivated player that doesn't want to be there, who the team has been built around as being the star for the last seven seasons, that's so hard to try and change. So that wasn't an easy situation for him. But the fact that he hasn't been able to turn that around, the board and everybody's just thinking, well, if he can't get Harry on board and get Harry on side and scoring goals, and every other manager that's been here can, then he's not the man to bring us forward. And that's it, I suppose.
Stephen, what does that tell you about Harry Kane the person?
You know what, I've met him a couple of times, and from every single person I know that's worked with him will only give you glowing reports about his attitude and his work rate and his dedication. And I think there's much more has gone on behind the scenes than we're privy to when it comes to what happened and him not getting his move in the summer. I think there must have been something underhanded done or something that has made him go the way he was, because I feel for him to be in a situation that he's not performing, it could be a lack of confidence, which I don't think for him is ever going to be the case, because he's always scored goals no matter what he's feeling, or even when he's had knocks. I think it's down to how he was treated at the club and how something's gone on behind closed doors that has left him with such a bitter taste in his mouth, probably for feeling that he's been a player that's been exemplary for the team for so long on the promise that they're going to build a team around him. It's never really happened. And now I think he's just at the point where he's end of his tether.
Can Conte turn him around? I think he can, absolutely. Conte will, because he, again, let's go back to some of the chats that we normally have about the top level fellas with Klopp, Tuchel, Guardiola, the demands they put on players. And they shouldn't really have to put the demands in terms of, as you say, the players should be doing that themselves, but they absolutely put the demands on the players. And he's a high profile manager in terms of the highest level as well, so I definitely think he could give them a shake up and a rattle, because that's exactly what a lot of them need. So many of them just look like they're on easy street, even watching them in the flesh the other night. But I'd actually defend and stick up for Harry Kane a little bit, Ruby, because he's getting absolutely slaughtered, and I know he wasn't great by any means on Saturday, and he hasn't been great, but in terms of the service, what he's getting behind him, Lo Celso, Skip and Højbjerg, they won't get a game with Southampton at the moment, or Norwich. Like, they were absolutely horrendous, those three, and he's so reliant on the service from behind him as well. When you think of Spurs and Harry Kane banging in goals, and when they were brilliant under Pochettino, you think of the energy and the zest and the life they played with Eriksen feeding them balls behind him, Son, Dele Alli when he was on form, Dembele in midfield as well. They were top quality what I saw on Saturday, and in fairness to him as well, he's so reliant on that service. So I would actually defend him, because even at the ground, a lot of fans were giving him stick and beginning to turn. And it might be down to the fact that he did want to leave, and so what if he wanted to leave? You'd always want to go and better yourself. He wanted to go at Man City. He was after doing everything he could for Spurs for so long, for so many years, carrying them. Obviously it didn't happen, and I'd be with Steve, and he obviously feels very aggrieved with the way it's played out, and I know it's a reflection on him at the moment in the performances that he's given or whatever, but I would have a lot of sympathy for him.
Just before we move on, Stephen, just a word on, like, Daniel Levy is probably after Ed Woodward, is the most focused upon administrator in the Premier League, or maybe even in English football. Like, do questions have to be asked here? Because there was such a public flirtation with Conte in the summer when they got rid of, or, you know, at the start of the year when they got rid of Mourinho. And it was evident that Nuno was well down the pecking order in terms of managers that they were targeting. So you can commend the board that you've acted quickly and got rid of a manager after 4 months, which is a very difficult thing to do. But does there have to be scrutiny that you're now going back to the fella that you failed to convince to take the job in the first place?
Nothing's changed from them. I don't understand what's changed from the board's point of view. Why could they not stretch it out that much further from in the summer to get Conte and instead of now? Like, you know, they obviously didn't show him the ambition. That was the whole thing talking about. Spurs weren't showing the ambition to go forward. Conte just felt, and it, you know, that was down to they weren't guaranteeing on probably finances to go and spend in the summer window, in the January window. And then they end up getting, like I said, the seventh or eighth choice manager, Nuno. So, you know, Nuno was expendable, and that's why there's no... You kind of think it was easy for you to cut ties with him because they never really wanted him there in the first place. They went for a lot of managers instead of him. And I just don't understand why they're in a position now where Conte has even more power in his negotiating skills. They're going to have to offer more. And, you know, if the talks are talking about an 18-month contract, I'm kind of like, you know, that's not exactly... Getting Conte is showing ambition, but it's not showing ambition to have a manager for a long term. Like, you want to keep him there for a good few seasons to try and build something and go forward, because this is not a fix quick. It's not a quick fix for Tottenham. They're not going to be back in top four. They might be at the end of the season, but it's not going to be pushing for the league title. They're so far off City, Chelsea, Liverpool, and you throw United into that as well. So I don't get why they didn't just go gung-ho for him in the summer.
Alan, if we're going to... I don't know if we're going to, but who are we going to blame then for City getting beat by Crystal Palace? The players, Pep, or were just Palace that good?
Patrick Vieira. And since he's come in, he's done a brilliant job, Ruby. I know the results mightn't reflect down on the league table, but I watched him in a lot of games, and they were live even last week against Arsenal, and Arsenal got a late equaliser. But I think Vieira's done a great job, because it's very, very difficult. When you think of Palace, and obviously Roy Hodgson, the manager there, and I used to have great respect and do have great respect for Roy Hodgson, considering the longevity he had in his career, but he always had one style of play, and obviously Stephen would have played under him as well, so a brilliant football man, but he always would have had one style, and it was very conservative, very organised, well disciplined team, and that would have been the case with Palace. But finishing 15th, 14th, 13th, whatever the case may be, never really worrying about relegation, but never really kind of looking up towards the top end of the table, really, or at those maybe 7th or 8th positions or the European slots. But I think since Vieira has come in, he's had to change a whole culture in terms of the way they play, a turnover of players as well. But I think he's done a great job since he's come in, and that was evident at the weekend to go to Man City and obviously beat them as well. He's had Zaha playing very well for him, and he's the talisman, really. But I think Vieira deserves huge credit. Of course, the focus will be on City, but sometimes I think, Ruby, when the big teams lose as well, all the focus is on maybe a manager not doing this, that and the other, and we rarely give credit to the opposing team. But I think Vieira has done a really good job, and obviously that was the reason they got the victory at the weekend as well.
And Stephen, if you're on about players' attitudes, what about the Brighton players when they got 2-0 down against Liverpool to claw back into it in a team that are so red hot like Liverpool are?
Yeah, and it's just Brighton have been excellent, and it's similar to Palace. They had a manager in place, than Cristiano Ronaldo, a couple of years back, that would have been, if the team didn't want to progress and move forward, they were happy because it was like getting stability, staying in the Premier League, fighting off relegation, but always beating it. But they took a brave decision to bring in Potter, and they've changed the style of football. Last season, they just couldn't score goals. They're creating chances for fun, but they couldn't score. This season, they're actually hitting the back net, which is why they're doing so well. They cause you problems. They play a really kind of high press, intensive type of football that gets after teams, and it's like Liverpool was really interesting because both teams were playing, Brighton don't do as well as Liverpool, but they're a similar style of football, and to come back into the game where everybody at that point would have expected Liverpool to absolutely walk all over them because the way they're in the form, they're in Salah, you know, but to you gotta give Brighton credit, they were absolutely excellent to come back into the game the way they didn't get the goals.
Just on Potter, is he the most underrated manager in the Premier League, Stephen? Because, you know, like his name is kind of fleetingly thrown into, like, you know, he's fleetingly thrown around when a job comes up. But realistically, he's kind of like the fifth of five options when you're talking about who could replace Ole Gunnar Solskjaer if he was to go. But, like, you look at the job he's done there, and he's, you know, does it come back to this obsession that English football has with foreign coaches rather than necessarily developing their own or looking at lads who've come up through the ranks through English football?
Well, this is the thing. I just don't want them to be like another Eddie Howe that peaks and bursts onto the scene and gets his team playing really good football and then doesn't get opportunity. I think he's a better coach, and I think he's has done more than Eddie Howe's done in the sense of what he's done and the way Brighton play and how they've changed completely, and that he's taken over in the Premier League and adapted the style of football. So yeah, he is underrated, and I just think it is that there's managers out there that have got medals on their CV and have won things in foreign countries that are always going to be picked against England managers because they always feel that the style of football, but the way Parr plays and the way he has this Brighton side playing. But I think for him, he's in charge of Brighton. He has such power and control down there. I don't think he's going to be likely to move to a club unless he's going to be given something similar to have to kind of rule the roost.
Mm. He's almost like a director of football, effectively.
Yeah, he is. He really is. Yeah. Like, if you like, for instance, people link him with Tottenham, wouldn't they? But I don't know whether that'll be a fit.
Alan,
I think to be fair, Damien, I think he's probably still building his brand and he's doing a great job. But not alone is he doing that, and obviously the evidence is there to see in terms of the job that he's doing at Brighton, and obviously the path that he's formed to get this far as well. But I think it comes down to someone being courageous and giving him an opportunity as well. If you're talking about one of those big clubs, is he good enough to take over one of those mega clubs at the moment? I don't know. But certainly if you're comparing him to the likes of Solskjaer at Man United, and people would say, well, if he's in a job and look at the job he's doing, I would have Potter every day ahead of him, similar to Brendan Rodgers as well, absolutely all day long. I think, to be fair to Graham Potter, though, he's certainly on the right trajectory in what he's doing, and it wouldn't surprise me at all in the years to come if to see him at one of those clubs if he keeps performing the way he is.
So, Stephen, if City stumbled and Liverpool wobbled, Chelsea most certainly didn't. They won 3-0, could have been 6 or 7-0, and Tuchel has them flying every week.
Every week, and that's going to be the big problem, because you can't see them dropping many points at all. Even if they have, if they're terrible, they just won't concede many goals. They're so defensively solid. They're ruthless. Rudiger has been excellent. Christensen, again, another player who's done really well this season. And then you throw in the fullbacks who are on fire, and then the attacking threat they have. Like, they've got the best squad in the league all around the pitch. Like, when they take someone off, someone comes on that's arguably probably better than the person they took off. And Kovacic wasn't playing the weekend, but Kante was playing, and Jorginho. Like, the names just roll off the tongue, but the way Tuchel has them playing and the way they're set up, they're not going to drop points. They're just really not. So you don't want to see a big gap building, because that would be worrying for the likes of City and Liverpool, because I just can't see them being able to bridge it, because Chelsea are not going to slip. Well, I can't see them slipping up.
Ruby wants to talk to you about Shamrock Rovers in a second, so we'll come to that in a minute. But just, Stephen, before we let you go, arguably, like, one of the points that people are texting in about Roy Keane's comments on Sky, we'll leave them, because we could talk about Roy every Monday if we wanted to. Ramsdale's save Arsenal against Leicester, like, undoubtedly the best save we've seen so far this season, and a guy who's going to have to come prominently into discussion around the national side and, you know, his the pecking order for club and country.
Well, you know what, a lot of stuff was said about Ramsdale coming when they signed him for 30 million, and I suppose it was a big fee for someone to come in that looked like he wasn't going to play, so there was a lot of discussion about that, and Arsenal were getting slaughtered for that decision. Like, just think about the amount of criticism they got at the start of the season for that signing. It was like the worst signing ever to have someone as a number two and sell the other goalkeeper, so it seemed crazy. But looking out, fans are so fickle. He's like the best goalkeeper in the world at the moment and they're loving him, but the save was outstanding. But his distribution, his volleys, aside from volleys throughout that game, were just off the charts, and that's what Pickford has going for him. He's a good shot stopper and his distribution is decent, so he's got to be in the pecking order. But I think Gareth Southgate has a real soft spot, and you got to give it to Pickford. He's never let England down, even to come to the penalties and stuff and all, he's never let them down, so it'd be harsh for him to lose his base based on his performances just for country alone.
We'll let Stephen go. Stephen, thanks very much for being with us as always.
Cheers, thanks guys.
Stephen. So Alan, Rovers are champions, can they do the cup double? That's the next question.
No, because they're not in the cup, Ruby.
Who'd you invite me to then?
Sorry, it's Bowes against Pats.
I thought you'd bring me to a proper
Pats
game.
Is in the cup.
Sorry, a proper game. A proper game.
So sure,
this is a real Northside Southside derby.
Like, Shamrock Rovers would be playing.
Would you stop?
No, stop, Ruby.
Come here, I'll give you a lend of a few tracksuit tops and everything. I'll have you all decked out if you want to go. You can come with me. I'll bring you and introduce you to
Alan. No, Alan invited me, but I'm going to go to Ferry House to watch Honeysuckle and talk about something I know about. But no, go on anyway. So they're obviously not going to do that, but they've won the league title, Alan. It's been fairly ominous for the last couple of weeks.
That has, yeah. It was only a matter of time, Ruby. And to be fair, overall, they've been the best team. I don't think we remember too fondly as one of the best teams we've ever seen win the league. And I know Stephen Bradley has come out against that, obviously, the last couple of weeks and since they've won it, and just maintaining that they're not getting the respect that they deserve. But absolutely, they get the respect that they won the league and they're the best team overall. But as I say, the teams that have gone before them so far, and even the team they had last year, I don't think anyone will kind of debate the fact that that was a much better team when you had Jack Byrne and Aaron McInniff. So the fact that they lost them, I think they deserve credit to be able to replace, you'll never replace that quality, Jack Byrne and Aaron McInniff. But he did bring in Danny Mandrew from Bowes, and I think that was a great sign to try and close the gap a little bit in terms of the goals that they lost losing those two last year. And Danny has certainly delivered, and he's in double figures, I think 12 or 13 league goals, and he obviously scored the other night as well, so he's done really, really well. But overall, I suppose you would have to look at the challengers, and there was no challenge from Dundalk. Bowes got off to a dreadful start. Pats and Sligo were the surprise packages in terms of challenging, and obviously that challenge did fall away mid-season, particularly Sligo Rovers. Pats kept it going for a little while, but overall you would have to say, and there's no doubt about it, Shamrock Rovers have been the best team in the league. But I've been one of the ones that have been critical of them in terms of that they haven't kind of pulled up any trees and winning the league, and I think that's down to a couple of factors that I just outlined.
But just Alan, when you look at it, like, here we are, four games from the end of the season for the most part. Dundalk and Shamrock Rovers only have three games left to play, but you've got Pats have secured European football, Sligo, Derry, Bowes, potentially Drogheda, obviously fourth place is going to come into effect because Bowes and Pats are in the cup final, and the relegation playoff spot still to be decided. So for all that we lament the competitiveness of the league, okay, the quality might not be what it has been in recent years, but you hardly have a game between now and the culmination of the season that doesn't count for something.
No, and I think that's where, like, if you take it back there to what I was saying with Shamrock Rovers, they have been the better team overall amongst them. But you're bang on, Damien, when you look at maybe third down to ninth, there's nothing between the teams whatsoever. They're very similar. It almost reminded me this year of, you look at the championship in England, and every week team, everyone can beat everyone, and it's very, very competitive. I felt that was a little bit similar to what we had in the Premier Division this year, from third down to ninth. And as you say, there's so much to play for still, even with four games to go, that if Drogheda were to lose a game, they're looking over their shoulder at maybe being relegated, whereas if they win, they're only 2 or 3 points off being finishing third or fourth. So that just tells you exactly how competitive it is. And there's still a lot to play for. Obviously, there's games tonight, there's games Friday, and as we run down towards the end, there'll be lots of twists and turns. And I don't think Dundalk are out of the fire yet, even though they had a good win the other night. And you look at Finn Harps and Waterford. Bertram done a brilliant job since he's come in, but losing the other night puts them still in a lot of trouble. So, and on the other end, Bowes getting pipped again with the last minute goal from Derry, just when it looked like Bowes would kind of put themselves into pole position to maybe finish fourth. So there's still loads of twists and turns to come, which makes it good for us. But I do think that's a factor in why maybe you look at Shamrock Rovers at the moment. I think if Shamrock Rovers team that they had last year played in this league, they would have won it by 20 points this year.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. Pats against Bowes tonight, the cup final rehearsal. Sligo against Longford, both of those kick off at 7:45, and it's Finn Harps against Drogheda United kicking off at 8. Alan, we'll leave it there. Thanks for being with us as always.
Thanks a million, lads.
That's Alan Cawley with us there, and we're going to chat racing out with Ruby after the break. Stay with us.
Dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on, racing.
And you are very welcome back to the program. We have a text into 51552. Ramsdale played with two teams who were relegated for the last two or three years. The best save I have seen is Kasper Schmeichel's save in last year's FA Cup final. But you see, I did say the best save so far this season.
You did, Damien, to defend you. You did.
Yes.
But look, he was man of the match on Saturday, and the different scorelines tell different stories, don't they? You wouldn't, if you watch that game, Arsenal winning 2-0 doesn't bear a
and
true reflection on the game.
You could put the greatest goalkeeper in the history of the sport into a crap team, and they're still going to be a crap team.
Well, they won't have to make more saves.
Yeah, there you go. Right, we've loads to chat about. We'll look back on the weekend in a second, but to look ahead to the coming hours, Joseph O'Brien, obviously, Twilight Payment, carrying the strongest of the Irish interest in the Melbourne Cup overnight. Before we talk about the race itself, it's a remarkable hit rate for a lad of his age to have won a couple of Melbourne Cups in relatively quick succession.
Incredible.
I think the fact that it kind of, it's one of these things people wake up to tomorrow morning and you hear it on the sports news on Morning Ireland or wherever else. I don't know that the significance of it really hits home, what he's done in the last couple of years.
No, it doesn't here, but it would do with all of the expat community who are in Australia, without doubt it does. But look, it is phenomenal what Joseph O'Brien has achieved at his age. I mean, only 2 weeks ago he won the Cox Plate with State of Rest, which is one of Australia's other big races. The Melbourne Cup, it is the race that stops the nation. It's a handicap, but and it's an incredible day out. It has a huge following, and you kind of have to go there to understand it. Mm. Like we'd say National Day here, doesn't stop a nation, but it's probably the biggest following a race meeting we'll get. But the Melbourne Cup is bigger. I mean, even in Melbourne, like the build-up, I was lucky enough to have been there in 2001 or 3. I know it was an odd year because there's a Rugby World Cup on. And Maccabi Diva won it 3.
Yeah.
But the city, the Rugby World Cup was on in the city, but it was about the Melbourne Carnival. It was still about the racing. And it's a phenomenal day out. I was there again when Michelle Payne won it on Prince of Penzance, and Willie Mullins' Max Dynamite finished second. But it's incredible. And it does happen at 4 a.m, which probably means it doesn't get too many spectators from this side of the world.
But so what chance, obviously, Twilight Payment won it last year. The benefit of all of that is Kerry's top weight this year. So can they dream, or how, to what extent can they dream of a defence?
They can, yeah, and he's been in really good form. I wouldn't think it's a strong, I'd say it's a weaker race this year, Damien. There's way fewer European horses involved in the race because of the strict veterinary checks that the Victoria Racing have put in place. There's only Twilight Payment and Spanish Mission running from Europe. Spanish Mission is Andrew Baldings. Craig Williams rides that. Even with quarantine rules, there's no European jockeys riding down there. Jai McNeil rode Twilight Payment last year, and he rides Twilight Payment again this year. I mean, Pondus and Sir Lucan are ex Aidan O'Brien and Joseph O'Brien horses. They now run for Australian trainers. And the other Irish interest, of course, is Johnny Allen, who rides Explosive Jack for David Eustace and Kieran Maher. Johnny started his career with Joe Crowley in Piltown. He won the Victorian Derby last night, and he won the Cox Plate and State of Rest. So Johnny's been having an incredible time. He rides Explosive Jack, so we're giving him a cheer as well if Twilight Payment's not in the shake-up. Mm.
Just on Joseph, like, talk about dealing with pressure when, you know, you're born into what he's been born into and the expectation that's been placed upon his shoulders. But, like, you know, he has the potential to go on and have an even better career than his father.
I'd say without doubt. And, yeah, he was given a head start, and he'd tell you that himself.
Come here, and I appreciate that,
But there's a massive but to go with that. If you look at the connections of the horse of State of Rest that won the Cox Plate, they weren't owners that he inherited from his dad. They were clients that Joseph O'Brien got himself. Lloyd Williams owns Twilight Payment. He has Thunder Knight running at the Breeders' Cup and Thunder Moon running there as well at the weekend. They're all connections that Joseph made. Now, he was in the place to make them, but he made those opportunities. He's bought those horses and he's trained them to win these big races. Most people somewhere along the way, Damien, will get an opportunity. It's what they do with it. And Joseph O'Brien has taken every opportunity and scoring hat-tricks. He's not just hitting the target.
Mm. Okay, the other big event to take place in the coming days, the Breeders' Cup, which again, it's one of those ones that you could just sit in front of the TV for the weekend and savour the best of the best.
Yeah, look, it's in Del Mar this year, and I suppose from an Irish point of view, there's a small Irish contingent. You don't have the usual Ballydoyle battalions heading over from Aidan O'Brien's. Joseph has two entries, just Thundering Night and Thunder Moon. Aidan has a couple in, but hard to see which one of them you'd fancy. Love, Glanton, Mogul or Japan. But it's more the spread of Irish runners. I mean, Michael O'Callaghan is bringing Twilight Jet, and Lee Roach will ride that. I'm sure it's the first Melbourne Cup ride for him. I mean, Gavin Cromwell, who we more associate with the jumping, he runs Quick Susie, which Gary Carroll will ride. Derma Weld has Tarnawa, who will bid to follow up last year's win. Colin Keane gets back on Tarnawa after losing the ride in the Prix de l'Arc to Christoph Soumian. He's gotten it back for the Breeders' Cup. Paddy Toomey runs Pearls Galore. Billy Lee is going to go and ride her. Ger Lyons has Akinella. Colin Keane will ride her as well. And Edo McGuinness is bringing a Case of You, which Ronan Whelan will ride. So it's the smaller trainers in Ireland and the lesser known jockeys are all getting a chance on the biggest stage globally for horse racing.
Yeah, so like, where in the overall echelons of racing, would you put the Breeders' Cup ahead of the Melbourne Carnival in terms of quality or like again, I've never been to Flemington, so I buy into this cliche about it being the race that stops a nation, but which is the one that lads really want to impress at if you can do it at one?
I would say probably the Breeders' Cup. Okay. It's a bit like Cheltenham or the Grand National.
Yeah, here. Like it's two sides of one coin. You take either, but
it is two sides of one coin. Like, there's no doubt to win the Grand National is the most famous race, but actually for skill within your sport, Cheltenham are the championship races. So I don't know, is it like the old days, the FA Cup or the league? I don't know. I don't know which one it is. I mean, is this, if you're in Australia, is who wins the NFL? I mean, Etendia, probably not.
Probably no, that's it. Or who wins the Leinster Championship? Or proposal B hasn't been passed. Laytown today. It's one of these spectacles that looks brilliant on television, and the photos that will be in the papers tomorrow will be spectacular. Where is it in terms of quality?
The bottom.
I don't mean to be dismissive. I'm just, you know.
No, it is. I mean, it's unique, and there's six races there. They're not, by any manner of means, spectacular contests are for lower grade horses, but every day you have races, you'll have winners, and it is a unique venue. It takes a lot of pulling together. The Laytown Race Committee do a tremendous job. I mean, they have to build a race course once the tide goes out, and, you know, get them all finished before the tide comes back in, and they do a great job. It's unique. They're running straight lines now. I can remember being there when they would race down by the seashore and turn and come back up, mile and a half races. They're all 6 and 7 furlong races now, and have been for quite a number of years. But look, it is a race course.
But
and
is it a significantly different challenge in terms of, like, what it is you're running on and being so exposed to the elements as you
No,
would
I'll tell you what it does. It can light up different horses. Horses that may have lost their way on conventional race courses, whether it's the sea, the open expanse of the beach, I'm not sure, but you can get strange results, and it can ignite fire in horses that are going to be stale.
You enjoyed yourself in Down Royal at the weekend, no doubt.
I
fleetingly saw you on television at some point when I think the kids were looking for RTE Junior or something. But
me one of those back channels.
It looked great. How good was the quality, or what stood out for you?
There was great racing there. I mean, the Ladbrokes Champion Chase was a fantastic race. Frode On for Paul Nicholls and Brian E. Frost just held off Galvin. Manila Indo, the Gold Cup winner, was third. There was only 4 or 5 runners, sorry, but it really delivered. I thought Brian E. Frost gave Frode On a really good ride, and then Envoy Allen got his career, I suppose, back on track in the Joint Racing TV Chase. I only think he got it back on track, Damien, by showing his well-being. I don't think his performance did anything to catch my imagination. I was, if anything, a little bit disappointed with him, and it'll be a watching brief for him with me going forward.
Gordon Elliott, there's a farewell return to form.
Incredible. 7 winners in Down Royal over the weekend, 4 on Saturday. I thought his Phil Dore was really good in the 3-year-old hurdle, Mighty Potter. He won the Esky Lane, won the handicap hurdle, and American Mike won the bumper. He then went and won the Cork National on Sunday with Brayside. So yeah, he's back with a bang. But October, late October, early November would traditionally be months when Gordon Elliott is very strong.
Okay, Grant, we'll talk again, no doubt, about the redemption and everything else, that the other narratives.
I think that's history now, Damien.
But
I think
can
you commit a crime, you do your time, and you've got to move on.
And I would agree with you, but then the one of the main, now again, you were far more submerged in racing than I can.
I was quite vocal against what he did.
And completely justifiably so. But I still think for a lot of people, and maybe it's the power of social media, the thing that a lot of people who are not completely submerged in racing will have taken away from the weekend was an ever so tetchy interview with Brian Gleeson at one point.
Yeah, I know, but I think I wasn't working for RT, I was working for Racing TV, and I haven't watched the interview. I only heard it back where Brian used the word disqualified.
Yeah, and it was a suspension. It's important to clarify that, or it's important that that's...
Obviously, I think it was from Gordon's point of view, and it is. But look, as I think in life, you make mistakes, he paid a price for it. Hopefully he's learned from it, and on you go. Yeah. And I think when you look at what Gordon Elliott has achieved for a 44-year-old, and think what he could achieve by the time he's 64, I think he'll make up for the time he's lost.
Let he or she who has not sinned in some way, shape or form cast the first stone. Anyway, we will leave the racing there. We're going to chat rugby with Stephen Ferris after the break.
Game on UFM with Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Game on rugby.
So the Autumn Internationals kicked off at the weekend when the All Blacks hammered the Welsh 54-16. We have Ireland at the week, or Japan at the weekend even. Stephen Ferris, but there is no doubt those players will have one eye on what's coming up in 12 days' time.
Yeah, good evening, gents. Yeah, they certainly will. I suppose we all have a few nightmares of the Rugby World Cup in 2019 when Ireland went down pretty emphatically to New Zealand. But like, you need to play what's in front of you, and Ireland have got Japan coming up this weekend, and it was a tight enough game over the summer series when Japan actually played some really nice rugby and scored some very nice tries, but Ireland just had too much in the bag to get it done. So, no, I'm massively excited for the next 3 weeks to see what it's going to bring.
Were you surprised Mac Hansen was called into the squad, or should he have been there from the word go?
No, absolutely, I'm surprised. And just reading the Connacht website, actually, it says, you know, Connacht Rugby are delighted to announce the signing of Australian Mac Hansen. And, like, I honestly didn't even know that he was Irish qualified. And now, here we go. He's in the lineup to possibly get a cap for Ireland at some stage if things fall his way. But, you know, there's lads like Balakun, Conway, Earls, Larmer, Lowe. I know there's no Stockdale at the minute, but, you know, Mac Hansen's played some really good rugby over the last, 4 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks. And, you know, does he deserve his opportunity to be there? Me, personally, I'm not so sure, but that's only my opinion. And, you know, he's got to relish this opportunity and, you know, just got to get into that squad and see what it brings.
Japan will be a test for Ireland. As you said, it was only 39-31 during the summer, but they gave Australia a match only last week. They were only beaten by 9 points in the end.
Yeah, like, you know, the Japanese are... I know there's a good few uncapped players that have been brought over by Jamie Joseph, the head coach, but there's a few boys there. Lamba Shagney, who's the, you know, the captain of the team, he's been around the block. You know, Jimeno at number 8 is an absolute unit. Big Michael Leach is still trucking on. We all remember his heroics in that 2019 Rugby World Cup, bringing that Japanese side to the quarterfinals. So, yeah, you know, they've talented out wide also. Their skills are very sharp. They're generally very accurate. And, you know, they'll go fancy their chances, throw the ball around, and see what the outcome is. But, you know, Ireland can't take them lightly.
But, Stephen, I know Ireland will pay respect over the course of the week, and every player will be asked about New Zealand coming down the tracks the week after next, and the answer will be, no, it's all about Japan. But let's be very honest, you know, they've a very short run in, there's been limited game time, you've got some players will play the first game of the season this weekend, that this is the dry run for the first of 4 games against New Zealand over the course of the next 12 months.
It is, and even if I was in that squad, Damon, I'd be lying to you if I wasn't looking ahead to New Zealand. I know Japan are a tough task. Yes, they've got a number of good players. They're playing some good rugby, a good brand of rugby, but New Zealand are coming to town. And I think even, you know, watching that match against Wales last weekend, you know, Adam Beard, who had a really good Lions tour, was bang average. You had Alwyn Jones, who obviously went off injured, question marks over his fitness as well. A number of other Welsh players that haven't had hardly any game time over the course of the last 5 or 6 weeks, or the guys that have been on the Lions tour, and they massively underperformed. So, you know, there'll be a few question marks, especially over some of the Irish guys who haven't been playing week in, week out, to get those match minutes, because these New Zealand guys are on fire at the minute, and any opportunity given to them, they are so good at taking it. You know, turnovers, their set piece has been very good, and, you know, there's just quality throughout the whole squad. So, yeah, I think there will be an eye on next week, because Andy Farrell is going to pick a side this weekend in mind of New Zealand next weekend. So it'll be very interesting to see who he selects.
Yeah, because, like, certainly my expectation would be that the 23 that will be involved this weekend, you'd imagine 20 of them at least will be involved the weekend after, if not the full 23. But is he in a no-win situation in a way? Because there's always a clamour for change, there's a clamour for youth, but yet he's going to want to go with the tried and tested, who he knows will stand up and not be intimidated by the prospect of playing New Zealand.
Yeah, like Damien, there was a number of guys that got their opportunity against Japan in the summer series, and a few of those lads maybe took their chance and a few didn't. But he needs to build combinations to go into the New Zealand game, a bit of confidence, guys to be playing well with each other. And I think you're right, maybe 19 or 20 of those 23 will maybe back it up the following week against New Zealand. And that's what I want. I would want a good 50 or 60 minute hit out before facing the best in the world. And yeah, I think, you know, squad selection is going to be crucial for Andy Farrell. And then if they get a couple of good results, then I think he can just, you know, just throw a lot of young fellas in against Argentina. But yeah, I think the next 2 weeks are going to be very, very crucial for Andy Farrell.
Stephen, when you're watching the All Blacks at the weekend, their offloading skills, the speed of their defence, the power they had, what kind of a team does Andy Farrell pick to try and contain that?
Well, you got to meet them physically, and you know, looking back on the results, you got to score a few points as well. You know, looking through the New Zealand results over the last kind of 18 months, and the teams that they faced, the likes of Argentina, the likes of South Africa, Australia, and even Wales there, you know, they're still averaging 36 points a match over those 8 games that I look back against good opposition. So Ireland, I've got to score a number of points. For me, they've got to score at least 20 points in this game to give themselves any chance of winning it. I know back in 2018, it was 16-9, but look at the other result. You know, 40 points Ireland scored, and away in America, New Zealand scored 29. And I certainly feel that they're going to have to score a few tries if they're going to give themselves a chance. New Zealand, do you try to contain them? Do you just go out and throw the ball around yourself? You just got to limit your mistakes. You got to limit your mistakes, your turnovers. You know, you can't miss a tackle, and if you do miss a tackle, you got to make sure that your teammate has your backside covered. So, yeah, you have little room for error against the All Blacks, but every team knows that, especially Ireland. And if Ireland play to their potential, and the Kiwis are maybe slightly off it by 5 or 10%, it might be a little bit closer than what everybody thinks.
With a bit of luck, it will be. Stephen Ferris, thanks a million for talking to us. It'll be all rugby for the next couple of weeks, I imagine. But Adrian Eames is at Sligo Rovers. Adrian, how are you?
Not too bad, Ruby. Yeah, all set. A breezy evening here at the Showgrounds, although the wind has dissipated in the last few minutes. Sligo Rovers taking on Longford Town. 7:45 kick-off. We're still awaiting confirmation of the two starting teams, but it's expected that Sligo Rovers will be unchanged from the side that beat Drogheda on Friday night by a couple of goals to nil. A very good win, a very important win. Sligo Rovers very much targeting European football, currently in third position. That's been the goal since the season started. Obviously, you've got Derry City 4 points adrift of Sligo Rovers in fourth position, breathing down their necks. And of course, they play Waterford tomorrow evening at the RSC. And Bowes were in action against St. Pat's at Richmond Park this evening, also in contention, 6 points down. And Drogheda, they perhaps are on the margins of things. They take on Finn Harps tonight. So it's a big game for Sligo Rovers. They're expected to be unchanged. Longford Town, for their part, relegated. But Darragh Doyle, their manager, certainly looking for a strong finish to the season before they head into the First Division next year. But all set at the Showgrounds for what is a very important game.
Sligo need that result tonight to keep themselves where they want to be. Damien, are you going to watch Bowes, or are you going to hide in the shed?
I'm going to go home and watch it on LOI TV.
LOI TV.
Sit down with the young one, and there you have it. Anyway, we'll leave it there.
We will indeed.
Thank you for your company over the last hour.
Thank you.
Laurie
Cheers,
Davis was our broadcast coordinator. The programme produced by Ronan Lawler. Tara's on the way from all of us here. Good night.
High protein cooked chicken breast fillet. Available in selected stores nationwide.